Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Perpetual Notion Machine on this fine Thursday, October 22nd, 2020, still. So tonight, I'm your host, Josh Mitchell, and joining me actually tonight, this feels extra special, is my wife and fellow scientist, Josie Mitchell. So tonight, we want to talk about the six different Nobel Prizes that are going to be awarded for 2020. And we're going to do an additional dive into one of the most important genetic techniques to come our way, CRISPR-Cas9. And so this is a special focus for Josie, actually, as she's a graduate student at UW-Madison, who works with Jill Wildonger, who helped pioneer CRISPR-Cas9 genome editing in fruit flies, along with some other UW professors. So to start, let me thank everyone for coming out. Welcome, Josie. Thanks for coming in today.
Thanks for having me. I'm excited to talk tonight.
I know this is the special new couples night. And, you know, I recently heard that if couples can do a radio show together, they can handle anything.
I agree.
I heard it on the internet, so it's got to be true. Let's get started. So, Josie, let's let you do a little bit of intro. So do you want to talk a little bit about yourself? What got you into science? A little bit of the work in the lab, too?
Yeah, absolutely. So I grew up in Michigan, and so I'm a Michigander. I'm actually a Youper from the Upper Peninsula. So I grew up doing science with my dad and majored in biochemistry in undergrad, got my Bachelor of Science in biochemistry, and I just really fell in love with research. So in undergrad, I studied bacterial resistance to antibiotics and how bacteria can basically chew up antibiotics, making them ineffective. So we researched how to prevent that from happening. And I really fell in love with the process of asking questions and doing research, as well as teaching and mentoring students. So that led me to grad school, where I wanted to continue that. And the very first time that I rotated in Dr. Jill Wildonger's lab, I got to image fruit fly neurons under a microscope. And I was mesmerized and immediately wanted to join her lab. And so I've continued my work. So I'm in my fourth year right now and still love imaging neurons every day.
That's just awesome. So I figure let's dive into this. So Nobel Prizes, right? We get them every year. And we have six Nobel Prizes that we want to talk about. And like I said, one in particular, chemistry. So there's 12 winners for 2020 in respect to kind of people or groups. And so we've got medicine, we got physics, we got chemistry, literature, peace, and economics, right? So those are our six categories. So starting us up from the top, right, is medicine. And so this was awarded to Harvey Alter, Michael Hutton, and Charles Rice. And so Nobel Prize in Medicine this year was actually all about the liver and hepatitis C. And so hepatitis C is at least one of three well-categorized hepatitis. There's actually a couple of more. I don't know much about them. I'm not in medicine. So what was really interesting about the Nobel Prize for Hep C is that this was actually a lot of work from the 70s and 80s. And one of the concerns was that when you would get blood transfusions, you would have viruses that could be included that people weren't screening for. And hepatitis C is a big deal. It causes chronic liver damage, and it's viral. And so this was a huge issue. And what the researchers ultimately did is they proved that Hep C alone could actually cause liver damage and disease. So this was a huge deal. It saved millions of lives. It's made us feel that much more comfortable with our blood transfusions and medicine in general. So this was incredibly nice. Okay, so going from there, right? Physics, the big award in physics was for black holes. So this was Roger Penrose, Reinhard Genzel, and Andrea Ghez. And I'm going to start right off by saying I feel really bad that I'm probably going to screw up names when I pronounce them. So just know I apologize for anybody who is taking the names really seriously, because I just don't know how to pronounce all of them. So the big work was actually kind of split in two parts. So we got Roger Penrose. So his big work was actually after Einstein talked about his major theory of relativity and did his work about the theoretical implications of black holes possibly existing. And so what Roger Penrose did is he was actually able to show that black holes could exist as the singularity. So this was a big deal. And this was accompanied by Reinhard Genzel and Andrea Ghez later, who were able to show by focusing in on, oh, let's see, what was it? It's Sagittarius A, I believe, in our own galaxy. And what they were actually able to do was show that black holes exist, and through imaging, right? So Roger showed that theoretically they exist. Reinhardt and Andrea, they were able to show it, right? So this was actually demonstrating Einstein's theories that black holes not only exist, and, you know, they're possible, which was absolutely awesome. Okay, so chemistry. This was, Nobel Prize was all about CRISPR. And so this was Emmanuel Charpentier and Jennifer Doudna. Hopefully I got that one right. And so they really pioneered the work on CRISPR. And so I'm not going to go too in-depth because Josie's got a lot to say about that because she works on it. So after chemistry, we got literature. So this was for Louise Gluck, who was an American poet, and she's considered one of the premier contemporary poets. So that's always kind of fun to see. Nobel Prize in Peace went to the World Food Program, also known as the WFP. And so the World Food Program has actually served 100 million people across 88 different countries. And so this is absolutely incredible work. Economics, the award went to Paul Milgram and Robert Wilson. So this one, I find the economic ones are always interesting. You never know what you're going to get. So what's really interesting is that they really worked on pioneering auction theory and the difference in, you know, expanding on the auction theory. And so their work in developing these different types of auction theory has actually led to their use with different businesses and governments worldwide using this for auctioning their assets, right? The very radio we're on, part of the actual, how the radio channels were actually distributed was done partially through this auction system, which is really cool. So, but going back to our main focus, right? And the reason that Josie's here, let's dive into CRISPR a little bit in chemistry and why this is not only so important for us scientifically, but what actually makes this really interesting in respect to the award itself with Emmanuela Charpentier and Jennifer Doudna. So Josie, do you want to start off why the CRISPR Nobel this year is so special?
Yeah, so the CRISPR Nobel Prize this year that went to Emmanuelle Charpentier and Jennifer Doudna is really a special award. It's the first time that more than one woman without a male contributor has ever received the Nobel Prize in science. So that's a pretty big deal. It's a big deal for aspiring female scientists or any aspiring woman in their field, especially STEM fields. And another thing that's really quite interesting about this award is that normally, Nobel Prizes occur years after the fact, so years after the discovery. However, the discovery and seminal paper for CRISPR was published in 2012 in Science magazine. And so the fact that, you know, 8 years later, we have this Nobel Prize awarded to these two talented researchers is pretty incredible.
Yeah, that is honestly pretty amazing. So how about, you know, CRISPR itself, right? So what's making this so amazing?
Yeah, so the technique of CRISPR has been known about since the 1990s. So in the 90s, microbiologists actually knew about CRISPR. And so before I actually dive in, I'm realizing I should probably define what CRISPR is and what this award was for. So CRISPR stands for Clustered Regularly Interspaced Short Palindromic Repeats. And that's probably the only time I'll say that because it's a mouthful. But CRISPR is a technique that allows scientists to use this strategy to cut DNA. So it's revolutionary because it allows a researcher to engineer a genome by cutting the DNA with these molecular scissors. And then that DNA can be edited. And so we'll talk some more tonight about how it can be used as a potential therapeutic, but it's also revolutionized how we do research and how we manipulate the genome of certain organisms in order to research those organisms. And so the basis of CRISPR, like I said, in the 90s, it was known that bacteria had these short repeats in their genomes, in their DNA. And people didn't really know what those repeats were for. It was just an observation that they had these repeats. And so microbiologists really focused on kind of characterizing the repeats, but no one really knew about this DNA cutting ability. However, in the early 2000s, several researchers were actually studying the bacteria called Streptococcus thermophilus, and they sequenced the genome and found these CRISPR sequences. And then in 2007, believe it or not, there were actually some researchers working for Danisco, so a yogurt company. And I think it's fascinating that this research really started off with a totally different question and just the curiosity of these scientists. And they actually found out that Streptococcus thermophilus was using this CRISPR as an innate immunity. And so this is actually the immunity of bacteria. So kind of like humans have an immune system, bacteria also have an immune system to fight off viruses. And so they found that it's this protein called Cas9. And that Cas9 is a nuclease. So nuclease just means that it can cut DNA like scissors. And so this paper in 2007 by Philippe Horvath figured out that the Cas9 protein could cut DNA and led to bacteria being immune to certain viruses. So that was kind of the early... Oh, go ahead.
Oh, I just wanted to ask, so what was the yogurt company? Why were they so interested in CRISPR at the time?
So the yogurt company was just studying the Streptococcus thermophilus, and I'm honestly not sure what their initial question was. They had figured out basically that the Streptococcus thermophilus had these repeats, and they were looking at the repeats in terms of how the bacteria could fight off viruses, because you need a good bacterial culture in order to culture yogurt. And so they were studying basically the bacteria themselves and how they could fight off pathogens or phages that basically could attack the bacteria.
Well, that's pretty cool. Yeah. I mean, who would have ever thought that big dairy would have been the one to really start us on this, you know, Nobel Prize affair almost. That's pretty cool.
Yeah. And it just goes to show too, that many, many scientists and researchers and questions, you know, came before Jennifer Doudna and Emmanuel Charpentier really did the experiment that showed that CRISPR-Cas9 could edit DNA. So as with any great scientific discovery or any discovery in any field, it's really on the backs of many, many students, graduate students, postdocs, research professors, senior scientists. Everybody's really working together, and a lot more science gets done when there's collaborations. And that actually leads me to how Jennifer Doudna and Emmanuel Charpentier kind of came together and put their brains together. So they met at a conference, and you know, it's told that they had a long walk on the beach and came back really revved up about this idea they had. So Emmanuel had actually published something about CRISPR earlier in 2011, but it really took these two female scientists coming together, and then they went back to their labs and worked extremely hard in less than a year to try these experiments and then publish their seminal paper where they actually could take the CRISPR system and very specifically cut a sequence of DNA. And that's the advantage of CRISPR, is you can actually design the exact spot of the DNA that you want to cut. So this is where it has a lot of promise as a therapeutic, and also can be used in the lab, because if there's a gene that you want to study or a gene that you want to manipulate in the DNA, you can actually use these sequences to be very specific, kind of like Velcro. And the Velcro will match up with the DNA sequence that you desire to cut. And then the Cas9 protein actually does the cutting where it comes in and cuts near a sequence called the PAM sequence. So you may hear that. But they were the first ones to really show that you could do this in vitro or in a test tube.
Well, that's actually really cool. Oh,
man. Yeah, and you know, it wasn't totally brand new that... that you could cut DNA. So there were some other ways that scientists had discovered you could cut DNA. So there's something called a zinc finger nuclease. And these were known about. And another DNA cutting mechanism is called TALEN, or transcription activator like effector nucleases. And so scientists were able to cut DNA for some time, but CRISPR has really revolutionized field with its simplicity of design. And basically one of the advantages is that you can really target that Cas9 protein to cut the specific DNA sequence that you're interested in manipulating. So I can talk a little bit about like how I've used CRISPR. I actually use CRISPR in the lab for my own research in grad school. So Dr. Jill Wildonger, my advisor, along with Melissa Harrison and Kate O'Connor Giles, two other female professors at UW. Kate is now not at UW any longer. However, these three professors, after the paper was published in 2013 by Jennifer Doudna and Emmanuelle Charpentier, they thought, you know, we work in fruit flies. Let's go ahead and give this a try in fruit flies. And so within a year, they had tried this DNA cutting technology in fruit flies and were able to show that they could, in fact, use this same system that was used in a test tube to be able to manipulate the genome of fruit flies. And this is pretty awesome and has, you know, really spurred a lot of research in the fruit fly realm. So for my own research, the particular gene that I study, I was actually able to use CRISPR to be able to make mutants, to tag it with a fluorescent protein so that I could visualize it with a microscope. So CRISPR has really allowed me to do a lot in my own research as well.
So if you were going to try and tag proteins or get rid of them, I mean, what would you have to do otherwise? I mean, how much time do you save and stuff like that? I mean, what's really making this so cool?
Yeah, so it saves a lot of time. So it used to be, you know, when graduate students were in grad school, if they were manipulating a gene, that could be their entire PhD. That could be their whole thesis, is just characterizing a gene or figuring out a way to either create a knockout. Which there were other genetic techniques. You know, my expertise is in fruit flies, but in mice, we've got like the Cre-Lox system. In fruit flies, we've got transposable elements. So different organisms, and I should mention these are model organisms that we can learn a lot about because there's quite a bit of conservation between a fruit fly and a human, believe it or not. So fruit flies, mice, worms, all of these model organisms have taught us a lot about molecular biology, biochemistry, biology that we can then apply to human health. And so, like I said, you know, it used to be that a whole PhD thesis could be spent on, you know, generating a deletion of a gene to study what happens when you delete that gene. However, now we can, you know, within, you know, the order of weeks to months, do this process. And so it's kind of turned into a revolution in the molecular biology world. So I don't think there's really anyone who works in biochemistry or molecular biology that either hasn't used CRISPR or knows quite a lot about it or knows someone who uses CRISPR. So for me, you know, my first year of grad school was spent using CRISPR to knock out a gene. So knock out just means delete the gene, study what happens when that gene is gone, but then also put back into the genome that gene that's tagged or mutated. So I could generate many, many mutants in, you know, the last 4 years versus spending my whole PhD looking at just one. So it's really revolutionized our ability to do molecular biology in the lab.
So, I mean, it's incredible to think of CRISPR as a tool, especially using a bacterial defense mechanism, right, to protect itself against viruses. And now here we are applying it as therapies, right? So is CRISPR, is it really, oh, I don't want to say effective, but, you know, there's some concerns with CRISPR, right? I mean, there's a lot of drama, you could almost say, surrounding CRISPR in different ways, right? We've got another lab that wants the patent. We got, you know, the medical practice. But I think let's talk a little bit more about the science, right? So what about the struggles with CRISPR being on target, right? Is CRISPR really on target mechanism? I mean, can it affect other genes and other pieces of DNA? Or, I mean, what about that?
Yeah, so you bring up a good point. CRISPR is not foolproof. So it still requires a lot of troubleshooting. It's a very young technology. So it's only really been being used as a technology for about 8 years. And so when I think back to 2012, that's when I graduated high school, and it really doesn't feel that long ago. So it's a very young technology that still is being developed. And so with that comes a lot of implications too. So, you know, there's a lot of ethical questions that scientists are faced with. I would say when we're using CRISPR as a technique in the lab, it's a very, very safe way and efficient way to manipulate a gene. So, you know, never before were we able to, with such precision, cut DNA, and then you can either, you know, leave the DNA cut, and that'll often generate a deletion of the gene, or you can supply the cell with a template DNA. So this is a way that you might then insert something into the genome. So cells have their own way of repairing DNA. And so as scientists, we can actually hijack that and use these DNA repair mechanisms to our advantage. So there's kind of two different DNA repair mechanisms that can happen. When Cas9 comes in and cuts the DNA, you can have something called non-homologous end joining. And this is when, think about those double strands of DNA being cut, and then they just get glued back together. Well, oftentimes when they get glued back together, some sequence gets lost. And so this will often generate something like a knockout or a deletion of that gene or the protein product. The other thing that can happen when Cas9 cuts DNA is you can get something called non-homologous, non-homologous end joining. This is homology-directed repair. So homology-directed repair is actually what our cells rely on when they're damaged. And so everyone's got two copies of each chromosome, one from mom, one from dad. When your DNA breaks, your DNA on one chromosome can actually line up to the DNA on the other chromosome and basically say, okay, you know, I know the sequence I need to fix this break with by using the other chromosome as a template. And so this happens in our cells, you know, on a daily basis when our DNA is damaged. However, for CRISPR, once Cas9 cuts, we can supply a template DNA that kind of acts in lieu of that other chromosome. And so what it allows is that DNA repair to then occur using that as a template. So if you want to insert a gene, once the DNA is cut, it will then use that template you supply to fix that cut and incorporate the DNA that you as a scientist supply. So we're really taking quite a bit of like technologies that happen naturally in cells or naturally in bacteria and using them to our advantage in the lab. And this lets us do a lot of stuff with our experiments. However, you know, when thinking about CRISPR outside of the lab, and the future of CRISPR, you know, there's a long way to go before we can use this as a reliable therapeutic. So there's a lot of promise, you know, in knowing that CRISPR can manipulate DNA. And I wanted to point out, there's a really good quote, and it's kind of a very innocent quote from the postdoc, Martin Jinnick, who is the postdoc on that seminal paper of Jennifer Doudna and Emmanuel Charpentier. And he says, "We were hoping that we could really translate this into a technology for rewriting the genetic code of cells and organisms. What we didn't quite appreciate was how quickly the technology would be adopted by others in the field and then pushed forward." So I think that really stands out to me, because when they were in the lab doing these experiments, they were just following up really cool science and really cool questions. And then all of a sudden you have to think about, you know, what happens when you manipulate a human's genome? One of the big concerns is using CRISPR in humans, depending on, you know, which stage the CRISPR therapy is applied, it can edit the germline, meaning it can edit DNA in future progeny of that organism or of that human. So a lot needs to be learned and considered before considering it for use in humans as a therapeutic. But I do think that there's a lot of promise. So there's promise for curing inherited genetic diseases, things that really are debilitating to humans and could lead to better life, you know, to use it as a way to fix genetic diseases. But of course, with that comes a lot of caveats too, because... And scientists, and especially Jennifer Doudna and Emmanuel Charpentier, they've led efforts really looking at the ethics of this. So they're not naive to the fact that this tool, if taken out of context or used irresponsibly, could be detrimental. So I think that's really important to keep in mind is, as with anything, it still needs quite a bit of troubleshooting. And we're all working hard in the lab right now doing that.
I think that's kind of a why. I mean, how true it is, because here we sit about, what is it? Has it been about a year, Josie, since the CRISPR babies in China?
Yeah, it's been about 2 years, actually. So that was 2018. Oh, really? Yeah, there was a scientist in China who published and claimed that he used CRISPR to manipulate the genomes of twins who were born in China. And this, you know, really became a big deal because it's not legal in any other country. And honestly, I'm not sure the situation in China right now, but right now CRISPR is not legalized to be used, you know, to manipulate human fetuses that will be born. It's used on cell lines, it's used on mice, it's used on fruit flies, C. elegans, all other organisms, but it's still a very young tool used to learn more about organisms and learn more about treating disease, but definitely a long way to go before it can be used reliably. CRISPR still has quite a few off-target effects. So, you know, you might be targeting one gene, and depending on the DNA sequence, it could match up with another section of the genome. So that's something to consider too, is, you know, you don't want off-target effects when you're using it as a therapeutic. So that needs to be optimized as well.
Yeah, I think one of the interesting parts too is, so this is an article out of Nature, and one of the things they talked about is that in 2019, there were more than a dozen active studies that were testing CRISPR-Cas9 as a treatment for a range of diseases. And they talk about things like cancer, HIV, as well as blood disorders. And it's amazing to think that, you know, since that seminal publication, right, 2017, that we're at a point where we're already not just using the technology in a light way, but really diving into this technology as a therapeutic. I mean, when you think about how some technologies have taken a really long time to develop, it's shocking at how quickly we can move in science nowadays. Kind of like, you know, the vaccine development, where, you know, how many years, decades did it take for things like smallpox and to develop those vaccines? And here we are, you know, in less than a decade, already looking at how we can use this technology to perhaps get rid of certain diseases that were otherwise incurable. I just think that's amazing.
It is amazing. Yeah. And honestly, Jennifer Doudna and Emmanuel Charpentier are kind of the heroes of our generation for CRISPR.
That's awesome. Well, Josie, I thought it was muted for a moment. All right. Well, Josie, thank you so much for coming out. I really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me. This is fun.
All right. And so that is our show. That is our Perpetual Notion for tonight. So thanks for tuning in. And thanks to my co-host, Josie. So extra huge thanks to our engineer and our fearless leader, Charlie Pittman. For more information on this show, find Perpetual Notion Machine on Facebook and Twitter. Lonesome outer space invader blasting through the night.